Hey everybody, welcome to this week's OIG Roundtable. Here with my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG out of the LA office, which isn't really in LA, it's in Santa Ana, the OC. We then decided when he was done working in Shangri-La, he had to go to something other than Shangri-La. And a director on our investigative and auditing team. And of course, our papa, but I don't want to make you seem older than you really are, but you really are. Matt Kachansky, the retired SAC, special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our senior director of payment integrity. Today's discussion is an enraging one. I just had to take the block. I had a Fred Flintstone block of ice on top of my head because I was so hot under the head and collar over this one. So out of California, podiatrist. People who follow this podcast know podiatry is my absolute favorite specialty to talk about. Podiatrist out of California, sentenced to 63 months along with his partner in crime, a sales rep from a manufacturer distributor of skin substitutes. That's the flavor of the day, skin substitutes, wound care. Sentenced to 63 months. We don't think that's enough for this particular case. They were treating people with wounds, including people who had amputations, with skin grafts. So you would immediately say, why is that a problem, Eric? He's a podiatrist. And as Seinfeld says, the man's a doctor. And so therefore, what would be the problem if you are providing a skin substitute to someone who has an amputation or a non-healing ulcer from neuropathic neuropathy, diabetic neuropathy. Why is that a problem? Well, it's not a problem unless the person that's rendering the services is the sales rep and isn't a doctor of podiatry medicine, a DPM. And that's what was going on here. So in this case, the sales rep for the distributor or manufacturer was coming into the office and he was performing the debridements and performing the skin grafting. The skin substitutes, the amniotic skin substitutes. So this is an enraging one because if anybody knows what happens in the world of skin debridement, it requires the use of a sharp object, typically a scalpel, to debride the wound until it bleeds. So you have to get clean margins on the wound so that you have fresh skin that you can then attach the skin substitute to promote healing. And in this case, what we learned is that from the press release, that people were calling the sales rep Dr. Gabe because people actually thought that he was a podiatrist and he was coming in and he was rendering those services. He was doing them when the podiatrist of record who owned the practice wasn't there. And it looks like it was from 21 to 24. In 2021, it was a little over $120,000 or $30,000. And by 2024, it had been about $3.2 million is what ultimately was ascribed as the fraud amount in this case. Although there was a judgment, there's more money, there's probably a global resolution that we don't see. But obviously, there's a hockey stick in from 100,000 to what amounts to roughly an average of $1 million a year in billings for these skin substitutes. And they are expensive, but you know, this is something where the data is going to show this. So Wade, this is one of those examples where we often say in the SIU space, the first question is, when should we interview members? When should we interview beneficiaries? People talk about templates of interview questions. You know, we always say that's not the way to go. Interview templates are not always the way to go because when you do an interview template, you tend to just go through like a mechanical process. This is one of those examples though, where doing interviews with members. So first of all, the data should have showed something. You go from $100,000 in year one, basically, and then it goes up to about $1 million a year on average because we're talking about, you know, $3.2 million over about three or four year period. But this is one of those examples where you're going to want to do a couple of things when you look at that data. You're going to find obviously you're going to want to find the members who see that there was a bill submitted for skin substitutes or skin grafting, and you're going to want to see, are these people with amputations, for example? Like you want to hit the hardest You want to hit the worst of the worst in a case like this, right? So the data doesn't give you it's not going to give you the answers, but it's going to help you with identifying the universe. But this is one of those where talking to members is absolutely going to be a piece of the puzzle that's going to get you right to the heart of the matter very quickly, because they're going to tell you who the person was that allegedly rendered that skin grafting.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And so initially you get the billing spike, which is, you know, that's your first indication to look at something. That's what we call a red flag. But looking at the data and the medical records, like you say, aren't going to give you the true picture. You know, it boils down to interviews. You can look at records all day, but you have to get out there and talk to people. So what you're trying to figure out in this case, and maybe at initially just looking at the data, you're not even thinking, oh, it's somebody other than the doctor. You're certainly not thinking it's a sales rep who's doing these procedures, but you have to get out there and talk to the members, you know, ideally face to face. But you know, and a lot of times in SIU, everyone's working remotely. Maybe you can't do on sites. Ideally, that would be the best way to do it. But if you can't, that's fine. You can do it over the phone. You can share pictures and things of that nature. But what you're trying to figure out in this case is who's actually doing the procedure. There are some types of cases or procedures referred to as like incident two, where somebody other than the doctor billing it can actually be performing the procedure. But this is not that case. This is not an incident two case. So, you know, you just have to talk to I work cases on adult medical daycare that was a similar situation where the person who was billing was not performing the procedures, and it wasn't an incident two case. And it just got to the matter of talking to the members, and, you know, so who did the procedure? The doctor was claiming he was in the room, he wasn't. But even simple things like, oh, the you know, like in this case, they referred him as doctor, whatever. But in the case that I work, the person who was doing the procedures had a very thick accent from, I forget where, Puerto Rican or something like that. But the doctor did not. So we kept hearing from people, oh, he's, you know, and I don't remember how it even came up, but, you know, then after I'm hearing this, so did the doctor have an accent? Yes, he did. So these in-person interviews, you can get to the bottom of it, like who actually did the procedure. It might just be on physical appearance. There might be different instances. If you can do an on-site, you can go to the clinic or wherever it is and talk to the people that work there and figure out who, I mean, in this case, it's really getting to the bottom of who had the scalpel in their hand and who was doing the debridements. And
right,
you can't tell that from records. That has to be either right, in-person interviews or even, you know, through a Teams message or a Teams call, you could show pictures. Is this the guy who did the procedure? No, that's not him. That's really how you have to get to the bottom of it in a case like this. It's the interview.
Well, and you bring up a good point, is that the medical records are not going to show that an unlicensed person is doing the service, right? It's going to be right, an EMR record where someone is fraudulently logging in and ascribing that, you know, you have a scribe typing in that information, or you're doing it yourself and then sending off that record, you know, to the cloud, and then you're good to go. And that's a good point. The other piece, Wade, you bring up, which is a really good piece, is if someone, maybe they don't know the doctor's name, because maybe they're used to dealing with Dr. McFall, but Dr. McFall's away, and now this sales rep who they were calling Dr. Gabe is there, and someone's never maybe met him, and they don't know who he is. But, you know, you bring up a good point. Okay, I don't know the person's name, but, you know, did you hear what other people may have called him? Did he have an accent? Did she have an accent? What did they look like? And that's where your on-site is going to absolutely help. And again, when we talk about on-sites, SIU investigators should be very limited in how they are doing on-sites. It should be a very specific protocol and how you do them and how you achieve them. Even things like drive-bys and surveillance and all of that stuff from the SIU perspective, very limited, very specific. There is a huge liability that comes with that, particularly with using personal equipment, personal vehicles, and things of that sort. But you're 100% right, Wade, on how you kind of get to the bottom of those things, which kind of get you in that direction. And then Matt, you know, the thing I think that we collectively were frustrated. So there's a potential patient harm issue here. The fact that they're using a scalpel and doing all these other things, And, you know, I think what we've seen a number of these cases involving unlicensed individuals rendering the services. I know, you know, I worked on a case involving a guy who was an internal medicine doctor. He had five offices he was doing, and I know I've talked about this before, enhanced external counterpulsation, G0166, for people with unstable angina that surgical intervention would not be facilitated. Doctor has to be on site. As Wade put, it's an incident to service. But incident to doesn't mean that the person rendering the service isn't a qualified healthcare professional. Incident to services cover what they call NPPs, non-physician practitioners in the outpatient setting. Incident to doesn't apply in institutional settings such as SNFs and hospitals and things of that sort, but you still need to have people that are qualified. In my case, he was rendering physical therapy and EECP. People that were unlicensed, unqualified. The biggest concern wound up being that he was having his unqualified staff render ultrasound therapy, different than diagnostic radiology ultrasound. These are heated kind of lamps. If you don't know how to use the device, you can burn the skin of the person. So there are like the collateral effects of injuring people on something. You know, we're not talking about applying a hot pack or a cold pack, which can be done, for example, in a PT setting. Hot packs and cold packs can be applied by PT aides, right? Like, you know, minimal setup of equipment and things of that sort. We're talking about invasive related stuff. We know that skin grafts, skin substitutes, very big area of fraud right now. I know we're working on a lot of those cases on your team. But this is one of those where when you look, you see one of the things in the press release says staff and third party auditors. Now, we have no idea what that means. Could those be third party auditors that were hired by the practice? Could those be internal auditors? Could they be external auditors? But clearly, this wasn't something that was done behind the scenes, closed doors. Other people knew and other people were expressing concerns. This is one of those where if this was a case or a matter that was brought forward to a third, you know, let's say the third party auditor, you know, is someone external and it went on, at some point, someone has to, it was ignored. I mean, that's just really what it comes down to, is that it was ignored. And I would have to imagine that whoever it was, if staff were complaining about this and third-party auditors were seeing this, this wasn't something that was just contained within the internal operational piece. The fact that the greed got to these guys is just, you know, just kind of gets, it just boggles my mind.
Yeah, and I think we're understating the numbers a little bit here. Because I looked, the press release talked about the restitution, but there were forfeitures of over $13.7 million plus nine properties, unknown value to that. So the damages are probably much more than this $3.2 million that they've charged them criminally with. So this was a large scale fraud involving these two gentlemen, and on sites, you know, staff complaining about it. This is an area, you know, you wouldn't know it, you know, doing the, before you did the on-site, but this is a perfect opportunity for an on-site where you're interviewing the staff and like, oh yeah, I brought that to the attention of the doctor a year ago that this person shouldn't be doing it. You know, that's beautiful evidence for intent and knowledge. And, you know, and then you've got witness A and witness B, you know, the billing clerk and probably the nurse or something ready to testify against them. And if it was an internal compliance audit that was done, you've got a set of books showing that the wrongdoing was done and ignored.
Right. And Matt, one thing is, when people become participating in the Medicare and Medicaid program and they become participating in commercial programs, you have a contract. In the Medicare space, it's the 855 form, the enrollment form, right? If you've got providers that work for you, it is the reassignment of benefits, the 855R, if you have a group number, right? So there's a lot of stuff out there. In this press release, what we know is that the podiatrist of record was the sole person that was there. So the first thing, if you're an in-network provider, if you're working at an SIU and you are, you know, not in the Medicare space, we talk about this all the time. First thing you got to pull is the contract. What are the requirements to submit claims? When you're looking at that contract, who are the members of the group? Who is the designated representative to communicate, right? All these contracts have some information that shows who the owner is, 5% or greater, who's the point of contact, who's the billing company, who's the Who's the chief compliance officer? All the contracts have some information that's on there. Plus, you've got, of course, Google and public record searches.
Yeah, Secretary of State information, all of that stuff.
Yep. You've got that. And so if, in fact, this was something that was out there where staff had complained, it's probably not going to take more than a few phone calls to talk to somebody to get this, because clearly people are complaining about this. And if people are complaining, even the people that aren't complaining know about it. And they might say, hey, look, I don't want to get involved, but because that happens, right? Yep. That happens. And that's, yes, and that's where that background due diligence is really going to be of some, is of some value. And Matt, from an SIU perspective, if I was doing an investigation on this provider relative to skin substitutes, because we know this is a thing, one of the first things I'm going to do in my request is I'm going to ask in an investigational review, I'm going to ask for a couple of medical records, but maybe I'm going to ask for copies of information that support that you actually purchased these skin substitutes and where did you buy them from? Now, you now know the name of the company. Now, all you need to do is a little bit of searching. Oh, there's something called LinkedIn. If we want to know, for example, who's working at ABC Skin Substitutes, a little bit of Google searching or search engine searching, a little bit of LinkedIn searching, and maybe you're going to find that your sales rep is on LinkedIn, mm-hmm, and you're going to get some information, and you're potentially off to the races. This is a case where you could actually do a huge chunk of the work without leaving your desk.
Absolutely. Yep. And you got to figure with these types of cases, it's usually that they're exaggerating the size of the wound so they can bill more for the wound care kit for the substitute because it's paid by the millimeter. You know, so getting the inventory, the invoices from the manufacturer, from the distributor, is vitally important to these types of cases. Did they even have enough material on hand to bill for the amount of, you know, wound care that they provide or that they billed for? So that's, you know, that's the first step. And then you can take it from there as you build more information. Right. All right, who's the, you know, who provided it? What's, you know, and keep digging down until you get to, oh, this was going on. And this fact pattern, you know, we get cases all the time on whether it's, you know, incident two or an aide, a PT aide or a PT assistant was doing things that should only be done by the PT, or they didn't use the NPI number of the person that actually did the provide the service because there's a reduction in reimbursement if it's not the provider of, you know, the MD or whatever.
Right.
It's a different, this is a different level. This isn't even an employee of the provider. This is a salesman, no medical background that we know of, you know, going in and cutting on people while the provider is out of town or not available, or maybe he's in the next office working on, you know, patient B while he's working on patient A.
Right.
So they could bill more than, you know, get up to the $13 million in billing.
Right.
This is awful.
It's awful. This is, by the way, you used a very gangster term, cutting on people. That's very,
I was thinking
gangster.
More of a Jimmy Buffett song when I said that, you know, I never let him cut on me.
I took it as very gangster of you. I heard you're meeting with Snoop Dogg later for potential, for signs, gang signs. So wait, I want to give you the final word on this one, because this really kind of cuts, it kind of cuts into where oftentimes SIU investigators will have a level of frustration on not being able to get their case kind of to that next level because of limitations in what SIUs can do. But this is certainly an example where a little bit of creative thinking, I hate to use the term thinking outside the box, because I'm not really sure what the box really means, but this is one of those examples where you can certainly use a little bit of creative thinking. If I need to identify who Dr. Gabe is, and I, you know, if I have a complaint or I look at data and my data tells me, how did these guys go from here to here? And I interview a few members and a few of the members say, yeah, you know, when I went to go have this done, oh, by the way, I'm an amputee from the, you know, ankle down. They told me I needed the skin graft because I'm also diabetic or blah, blah, blah. blah, blah, blah is a very technical medical term. By the way, I'm not sure what the ICD-10 is for that. But when someone says, you know, I have blah, 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 and they sent me over and Dr. Gabe is who treated me, when, you know, your interview has now told you, you've got a name of someone, right? But this is one of those where you can really make inroads by just thinking a little bit outside of what the normal conventional look at data, request medical records is, right? There's a little bit that you can do where speaking to people and reaching out and a little bit of thought of being creative can really go a long way. It's not, this is a case where mechanical investigations may not get you where you need to be.
Right. And I think it was mentioned earlier, but just some basic internet searches can do wonders. If you look up the clinic, it's going to have, you know, the different categories, who we are, or our staff. You know, if there's a Dr. Gabe that's being reported as working on people, there should be a Dr. Gabe probably listed on the website somewhere. And there's probably oftentimes even pictures. So again, if you're going back to the interview portion, you might be able to find a picture. The other option is if you're going down the road, the investigation, you're starting to think that this could be, you know, somebody other than the doctor working on the members, depending, you know, the different SIUs have different relationships with, you know, might be the MFUCU, the Medicaid Fraud Control Units, whoever, that, you know, oftentimes will refer cases to them. So this could be a case where if you don't really have the ability to go out and do an on-site and you think that's what needs to be done, you talk to your law enforcement partners who are, you know, the boots on the ground. They're in that part of the city. They could easily go out and, you know, do the interviews. So having those kind of relationships takes it away from just a desk audit. If that's all you're capable of resource-wise, you have someone else go and do the interviews for you.
Well, and this is also an example of where our boots on the ground surveillance teams would be of great value, whether it be human centered surveillance or electronic surveillance, which we also have the ability to do, where you set up a camera or you have somebody physically sitting there for a day and you have them at the beginning of the workday when people are showing up. You know, our surveillance investigators will position themselves someplace where they'll be able to get plate numbers down, they'll be able to get people. Now you've got yourself a whole group of interviews that you could be doing to make some identification, because for all you know, maybe this guy, Dr. Gabe, shows up and you've heard this name, but you don't have a way to connect him to anything. And now you send out a surveillance investigator. And maybe Dr. Gabe shows up every Wednesday. They do skin grafts every Wednesday there. And he shows up at, you know, 8 a.m. and he's there. We don't know any of this, but these are things that putting a little bit of creativity to your investigation can go a long way when you make that, if you make that referral to law enforcement, if you are a third party auditor, as this press release talks about. Yes. So it is an interesting one. I will say from my perspective to see that, yes, there's a lot of money that was paid back, but to see 63 months is just unbelievable in the scheme of things, considering the amount of money that was involved here. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, when sentencings come about, there's something called the 3553 factors, which is, you know, sort of the factors that create, what are the things, right? Why are people put in prison? And it's for deterrence, it's for punitive, it's retribution, all of those things. And if you're talking about the deterrence factor, I think what we've seen kind of in the collective is that, prison sentences and things of that sort serve very little from a deterrence factor. People are not persuaded by going to jail, particularly in the white collar world, where we see oftentimes individuals getting very de minimis prison sentences and not being financially bankrupt. And I think, you know, the going joke is if you stole $5 million and you only had to pay back $2 million and you had to do a year and a day in jail, which is really 10 months, would you do a year and a day in jail to be able to make $3 million? So basically your return on investment, and a lot of the people that wind up getting picked up are in their end of their career anyway. So if you stole $3 million, that's just what you know, if you walked away with $3 million, did you really get more money? Probably. And would you do with that $3 million if you were already in your 60s? So I think, you know, 63 months, does it send a message? It obviously sends a message. Does it really have a deterrent effect? You know, we see these cases all the time. So, no, but, you know, at the end of the day, you got to do your piece of that puzzle. But I just think from an SIU perspective, what I liked about this case was the fact that there are some things that an investigator can do that are not just in that mechanical process of look at data, request records, seek an overpayment, move on to the next case. This is one where there's an actual impact that can be made as a result of working with law enforcement and other things. It's just, it's sad to see these cases. And it's clearly one of those where patients were duped, right? They're calling them Dr. Gabe. What do they know? People don't know. You show up in a lab coat. I was going to say a stethoscope, but I don't know if I'm going to put the podiatrist in the stethoscope. But you show up, you know, with a lab coat or scrubs, and people have, you know, a feeling that you're a doctor. You know, we see this a lot in surgical instances with device reps. Device reps will show up to the OR. They're wearing scrubs. People think everybody in the room is a doctor. And I think, you know, that's part of it is people just don't know, you know, because of the way that medicine works. And it's an important piece of it. And the sales reps know the products and how this all works. But the fact that you've got the rep doing the debridements and all of that is just...
That's why I'm hoping they still have money left over so that these patients can sue them individually and just take every penny that they have.
Yeah. Although it is a lot of money that was recouped.
It was a lot of money.
Nine houses or something, nine properties.
Nine properties. Yeah.
How many of those did he actually live in? How many of those are rentals as income property? I don't, you know, just, there's a lot to it. So, well, you know, this is a great one. The press release was a great one in the sense that it kind of gave a really good roadmap of the story. So that's what I think piqued our collective interests in this. So take a look at this press release, learn from it. Again, we always say reading these press releases gives you a lot of investigative direction on things that you may not think about. We try to put a little bit of extra color to it. So as always, it's great to get your insight on these things, Wade and Matt. I think this was an angering one for me, as it clearly was for you. I hope it angered everybody that paid attention to this podcast. So thanks as always. Again, we've got a bunch of LinkedIn Lives coming up. Weekly podcast, all to your newsletter, all in your inbox from our newsletter, plus our YouTube channel. You can find that right just by going to YouTube and type in Advice Health. You can subscribe to that as well as on Spotify. You're at the gym. You're doing your new workout, 12-3-30, 12-degree incline, 3 miles an hour, 30 minutes, drop 3 pant sizes. That's what they're saying. That's the new thing now. While you're on that treadmill for 30 minutes, you can listen to our podcast, which is about 30 minutes. Perfect timing. And spend your time, send us those pictures of your 3 pant size. Wade will take all those photographs of you at 3 pant sizes. Less so. As always, we appreciate by spending the time, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care.
Thanks. Thank you.